In 1867, Alexander Clark, an African-American man living in Muscatine, attempted to enroll his daughter Susan in the neighborhood school. He was denied, but he didn't take no for an answer. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. 86 years before Brown versus the Board of Education, Alexander Clark sued the Muscatine School Board. The result was the first successful school desegregation case in the country. Today, we'll find out more about the remarkable life of Alexander Clark. My guests are Kent Sissel of the Alexander Clark Project in Muscatine, historian David Broadnax, and Tom Moore, executive director of the African American Museum of Iowa. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 1868, just 3 years after the end of the Civil War, the Iowa Supreme Court ruled in favor of Alexander Clark in his suit against the Muscatine School Board. Clark, an African American, sued for the right to enroll his daughter, Susan, in their neighborhood school. It was the first successful school desegregation case in the country, a full 86 years before the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Brown versus the Board of Education. And that story is just one remarkable episode in the remarkable life of Alexander Clark. Today, we're going to find out more. And my guests today are Kent Sissel of the Alexander Clark Project in Muscatine. Hello, Kent.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being here today.
I'm delighted.
And also with us is Tom Moore, Executive Director of the African American Museum of Iowa, based in Cedar Rapids.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for coming back again, Tom.
You're welcome.
And also with us today is historian David Broadnax of Trinity Christian College in Illinois. Hello, David. Oh, maybe David's not quite with us yet. Okay. He'll be here very soon. But Kent, I want to start with you today because I want to go back before this episode that we've talked so much about, this remarkable case where Alexander Clark sued the Muscatine Board of Education or the Muscatine School Board. And I want to go back to find out more about who this man is and where he came from. Where was Alexander Clark born?
Alexander Clark was born in Washington, Pennsylvania, February 25th, 1826.
And his
family had been in Washington, Pennsylvania. His grandfather was the first to settle there and was there as early as 1792.
And was he born a free black man?
He was born a free black man. That is correct.
What brought him to Iowa?
It takes a lot of speculation, but one of the real curiosities of Alexander Clark's life, and actually the lives of a number of families in Muscatine, is so there are a number of families who settled in Muscatine from Washington, Pennsylvania. My mother's side of the family, my great-great-great-grandfather, and all of his siblings except for one, eventually moved from Washington, Pennsylvania to Drury Township, which is directly across the river. And there are other families who seem, we find more and more people from Washington, Pennsylvania. Something was going on there.
There was
so
some kind
of
connection.
Why did he come here?
Right.
Like, well, they probably, you know, most people moved to new territory based on the fact that they would have known somebody. And if you think about Alexander Clark being 16 years old, a black man traveling on his own, he probably would have wanted to settle in an area where he had some relationship with people already, either family established or personally established. So I think that he moved here primarily because he knew people, but he was also, I think, on a mission, the mission of his life, which was equal rights.
Do we know anything about his early education?
Again, we can only speculate. I think that he probably was relatively well educated, even though the biographies that were written about him say he received a minimal education. In 1820, Washington, Pennsylvania had its own black school, and an 1820 report to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania school system indicates that it was the best school in that particular borough. So I think that Alexander Clark probably had a relatively decent education early on. And I think he continued his education when he, at the age of 13, went to Cincinnati to live with his uncle for a couple of years and study more. That's also where he learned the barbering trade.
Well, he came to Iowa at 16, and he came here not at first to be a barber, which is what he did later on, but to chop wood.
Well, I think the first piece of information I have about Alexander Clark that was published in the Muscatine Journal is shortly after he settled here, he had a comestible store in downtown Muscatine. He was selling dried fruits. I don't know what else might have been in that store, but he was selling dried fruits. The only purveyor of a warehouse where he could have gotten those would have been Reynolds Drury. This gets confusing. Reynolds Drury's warehouse at Drury's Landing, directly across the street. Reynolds Drury being a combination of two family names, the Reynolds having come from Washington, Pennsylvania.
So more evidence of a relationship there.
Yeah, there's something there. But I think that he probably, in addition to all of this, since there has been speculation that, in fact, when Alexander Clark first came to this area, he lived in Drury's Landing and was living with Dr. Eli Reynolds, who was the first doctor in this part of the country. Dr. Reynolds connected to my great-great-great-grandfather. But if this is true, the Reynolds and the Drurys owned a great deal of property, and it may well be that Alexander Clark timbered their property for them. If they knew him and they knew he was industrious, he could cut the wood. They would get their land cleared. And Drury's Landing was a perfect place to sell cordwood to riverboats. It was the safest place. It was much safer than Muscatine for steamboats to going up and or down the river to pull into the wharf at Drury's Landing because it extended out into the river. There was no need to back up or turn around, and it was safer. So I suspect, and that's a story that I've been told, and the longer I look at this and the more carefully I look at it, I just have to believe there's some grain of truth in all of that.
Tom, let me ask you, so when Alexander Clark came to Muscatine, can you give us an idea of what Iowa was like for African Americans at this time?
Well, I don't have a totally clear picture, but I think at the time Iowa was showing there was a law on the books that actually prohibited African Americans to move to Iowa. It wasn't enforced. There was a lot of ignorance and fear. And, of course, the nation wasn't sure just what direction things were going to go in with the Civil War over. And at the time—
This was before the Civil War.
Yes. During that time, there was great anticipation as far as African Americans and where they might fit in. And I don't think it was the same type of fears that we saw with the Great Migration from the South with land values, but it could have been some of that. And so things were still segregated. And I don't think things were as bad as they got in the 1900s, the early 1900s.
I think that's absolutely true, Tom. Wouldn't it be nice to go back in time and really know?
Yes.
Because the question is asked often.
So Alexander Clark, you mentioned he was trained as a barber, and he became a barber in Muscatine. And
right.
That was an unusual position for, maybe not an unusual position, but an important position for an African-American man. Why was being a barber such a good position for Alexander Clark?
Being a barber, and actually for a free black man, being a barber was one way of increasing wealth because most men, especially well-to-do men, did get a shave every day, and their barber did it. So they had customers all day long. But the other thing is, it's the center of all conversation. The barbershop, as you know, we see in Norman Rockwell paintings, it was the center of all conversation, political talk, and decision making within a community. It was Alexander Clark was right in the center of whatever was going to be happening.
And this is an unusual position because he is an African American man who is interacting with everyone, all of the men in the community, basically, right? He has access to people that other African Americans at the time would not have had access to.
I don't want to make it sound like it was unusual for a black man to be a barber, because I think it was far more common than unusual. And there was already another black barber in town when Alexander Clark came here, Thomas Motts. But the
point is that he was operating in a field where he would come into contact with many people and
Absolutely.
Interact with them.
Absolutely, without a doubt.
I want to bring David Broadnax into the conversation now. He is a historian at Trinity Christian College in Illinois. Hello, David.
Hello. Hello, Hi. Tom. Hello, Kent.
Thank you so much for being with us today. And I know that you have done a great deal of research about Alexander Clark. So let's bring you into the picture at this point. He is a barber in Muscatine, Iowa, and he gets involved in helping fugitive slaves at this point, right?
Yes. There's one case in particular that we're aware of involving a man named Jim White, who had come up from St. Louis, where he was a slave. Of course, slavery is legal in Missouri back then, and apparently had come with his master's permission. He was supposed to work in Muscatine and then send the money back. And then once he got to Muscatine, to a free state, he decides, well, I don't want to be a slave anymore. And essentially at that point, his master has to, you know, forcibly bring him back to slavery. This is in 1848, I believe.
Yeah, 48.
And,
yeah.
I'm sorry?
No, 48.
Right. So so his master sends basically bounty hunters. There were people who did this for a living. Their entire bread and butter was, you know, hunting down fugitive slaves. And these two bounty hunters come to Muscatine to try to retrieve Jim White and bring him back to his master, and Alexander Clark actually intervenes on Jim White's behalf. So you're looking for more details about the story here?
Well, we can talk more about it in a moment. We need to take a quick break here. We're talking about the life of Alexander Clark, a remarkable man who lived in Muscatine, Iowa, before and after the Civil War. We'll talk more in a moment. My guests are Kent Sissel of the Alexander Clark Project in Muscatine, historian David Broadnax of Trinity Christian College in Illinois, and Tom Moore, executive director of the African American Museum of Iowa. We'll continue this conversation in a moment. You can find out more information on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio, and you can get involved in the conversation by calling us at 866-780-9100, tweet us at IPR Talk, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we are talking about the life of Alexander Clark, a remarkable man. He lived in Muscatine, an African-American man. In 1868, he sued the Muscatine School Board successfully. It was the first successful school desegregation case in the country, a full 86 years before the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Brown versus the Board of Education. But as we've been talking about, he was a remarkable man before that. He was a remarkable man after that. We're fleshing out the life today of Alexander Clark. And my guests are Kent Sissel of the Alexander Clark Project in Muscatine. Tom Moore is here, executive director of the African American Museum of Iowa, and historian David Broadnax of Trinity Christian College in Illinois. And so, David, right before the break, we were talking about this story of Jim White, a fugitive slave aided by Alexander Clark. And Kent, I want to ask you about this, too, because I know that there is a little bit of there is more. And there's some speculation about how this story was told and perhaps even immortalized. So tell me a little bit more, Kent, about Jim White and how this story was passed around.
Jim White was the property of Dr. Mary in St. Louis. I don't know whether Dr. Mary lived in town or whether he had a farm, but Dr. Mary gave Jim to his stepdaughter, Sarah Aker, and her married name was Hughes. Dr. Mary moved to Muscatine and had a large farm just north of Muscatine. And Jim made arrangements with Dr. Mary to work on a riverboat and buy his freedom. Jim worked on the riverboat. Apparently, there was a scuffle. Jim was injured. Sarah Aker Hughes, Dr. Mary's stepdaughter, sent Jim to Iowa to her stepfather to recuperate. When Jim was here, he probably knew he was free. I'm sure Dr. Mary knew that he was free, but Dr. Mary sent him to the American Hotel to work, and that's when Sarah Aker Hughes' husband chose to retrieve their property. So the story is, if everybody knew that Jim was free because he was in Iowa, why would Mr. Hughes do this? And we found out from family members. I happen to really know some of the descendants of the Mary family. We found out just a year ago that Sarah Aker Hughes' husband was suffering from cancer. And he was traveling all over Europe and the United States trying to be cured of his disease. But at the same time, he was trying to retain as much of the wealth that they had for the benefit of his wife, because he knew he was dying. Interestingly, then the story comes into play that, yep, Hughes sent somebody to get Jim. So that story seems to be fairly accurate. But curiously enough, Sarah Aker Hughes moved to Muscatine a few years later. Jim was still living here. Sarah Aker Hughes lived just a few blocks up from North, Alexander Clark, and they were friends. So you have to wonder about some of this.
Well, and there's a story about how at some point when the people were trying to take Jim White back to Missouri, that Alexander Clark took him out in a boat on the Mississippi River, and they floated away into the night. And you actually think that this story of Jim White may have inspired Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens?
I refer to this as a curious coincidence. We've got the story of Jim White and being in Muscatine. There is a certain drama associated with his life, the story of his freedom. Samuel Clemens was living in Muscatine in about 1852, 1854. I think it may have been four, because his brother was editor of the Muscatine Journal. Samuel Clemens worked at the Muscatine Journal as a typesetter for a period of months. The Muscatine Journal was just a block away from where Alexander Clark lived. It's entirely possible that Clark would have been Samuel Clemens' barber. But certainly Jim was still living here, so I think the story was still fresh.
So you think that it's possible that Jim White was the inspiration for Jim in Huckleberry Finn?
I think it's entirely possible. Yeah, I love raising the speculation.
Tom, you're laughing. I think you're a little skeptical.
No, it all fits.
Because there is no record of a Jim in Hannibal. The other curiosity of all of this is, we have coal mines in the Bluff, not far from downtown. There are caves.
Well,
and Samuel Clemens probably knew that they were there. I don't think anyone can say for sure, because we didn't live then and we don't know. But it certainly is fun speculation.
Absolutely, it's a wonderful idea. Well, let's move on, because we could talk about this for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And David, let me bring you back into the conversation. So we know that Alexander Clark was working to help fugitive slaves escape to freedom. Do we know how involved he was in the Underground Railroad?
We don't have a great record of this, and of course it's difficult to find records of any kind about the Underground Railroad or about people helping slaves escape from slavery, because people don't generally keep good records of how they broke the law.
Right.
And of course this is it's completely illegal in Iowa and under federal law to help slaves escape. So what we have a lot of is, after the Civil War, a lot of people claiming that, you know, that they were involved in the Underground Railroad in different ways. Some of it completely made up, some of it exaggerated, but this is one of these things where now that it's a good thing to say I helped fight against slavery, everyone wants to say that they did it. All that being said, we do know that certainly Clark is someone who would have been sympathetic to slaves, even though he had never been one himself, because his wife was born a slave, his mother was born a slave, and so even though he's prosperous and free, he would have still have felt a connection to this and certainly a desire to try to help other people who were, or I should say people who were trying to escape from slavery. We know about the Jim White case. Other evidence in terms of other things that he might have done, we don't have as much direct evidence about it, but it seems unlikely that he would have helped Jim White and that he would not have come to anyone else's aid. And we also know that there are fugitive slaves coming through Muscatine all the time, being on the Mississippi River, fairly close to Missouri, and, you know, sort of on the way to Chicago if you wanted to head in that direction.
Right.
So it seems entirely probable that we know about the White case, but there would have been other people who he would have helped as well.
Well, and with the beginning of the Civil War, Alexander Clark worked to recruit African-American soldiers to fight in the war, right?
Absolutely. In 1862, he writes to the governor, which at that time was Samuel Kirkwood, and he offers to raise a company of black soldiers to fight in a white regiment. For a company, you only need about 100 men. And his thought was, you know, there aren't enough African-American men in the state to fill a whole regiment. For that, you need about 1,000 people. But we can, you know, fill a company. And then, of course, this also would have meant that this regiment would have been integrated, which is something else that was important to Clark. And Kirkwood's secretary writes back and says, you know, we're not going to do this. You know that your people would not be tolerated in a white regiment. So that doesn't happen. But this is 1862, and a few months later, you have black soldiers fighting in Louisiana, in Kansas. Shortly thereafter, you have the famous 54th Massachusetts Regiment. In South Carolina, fighting in South Carolina. And so what happens is that the momentum shifts to where now, for a number of reasons, there's a greater number of white Iowans who are in favor of allowing African-American men to fight. So then in 1863, the military authorizes the raising of a black regiment in Iowa, and Clark becomes a civilian recruiter. He can't actually join the regiment because he's got an old injury that prevents him from doing military service, but he becomes a civilian recruiter and basically travels throughout southeastern Iowa. He goes all the way up to Minnesota, goes down to Missouri, basically trying to get black men to join this regiment, and in some cases actually gave people money out of his own pocket to get them to join.
And also, as a recruiter, he got $2 for each soldier he recruited, right?
Right. So I guess you could say it wasn't completely altruistic.
But there is a story. And Kent, let me jump in on that. The story goes that when he got this $2 per soldier, he gave it back to the soldiers.
Soldiers, so that they could buy the equipment that they needed and the uniform.
So
he did not keep any of the money.
Right. And so these soldiers went off to war. What happened with Clark next? I mean, did he continue to try to recruit soldiers throughout the Civil War?
I don't know that we know that for sure, but we do know that the vast majority of the black soldiers who were part of the Iowa First that became the U.S. 60th, they were from the Deep South. They were from Missouri. They were from Arkansas, Tennessee, Kentucky, Alabama, Mississippi, Texas. Most of them, and their nativity was in the South. So the assumption, Dr. Paul Finkelman has been doing some research on this. He is inclined to believe that Clark really got the word out to young black slaves that all they had to do was go to Keokuk, Iowa, join the army, put one foot into Iowa, and they were free.
So you believe that this was a continuation of his fugitive slave work in recruiting.
I think it may be the largest thing he ever did, if in fact all of this is true.
Wow.
But there is a reason, and it's one of the things that's very difficult to document. There is a reason that in his eulogy, there is the statement, Alexander Clark is best known by studying him as an engineer and conductor of the Underground Railroad. because it identifies his whole life pattern.
After the Civil War, this becomes a very, very busy time and a remarkable time. We've talked a little bit about the school desegregation suit, but he also was extremely busy. And Tom, let me bring you into the conversation again here. Campaigning to get African-American men the right to vote right after the Civil War. What do we know about the movement for that in Iowa?
That's an amazing thing. I understand that there was only one other state after the Civil War to grant voting rights to men, and it was prior to women being able to vote. And I really don't have a feel for the climate as much in Iowa. I understand it was done in appreciation for the service during the Civil War. And I'm not sure, Ken, how many of the recruits were from Iowa. But I think there were a number that did come back to settle. And I think for a period of time, it was a totally different place. And it was a huge step forward.
Well, and Kent, he tried to involve these men who had fought, that he had recruited, in the campaign to get the vote, right?
There was a large meeting of soldiers from the Iowa First at Camp McClellan in Davenport. And it essentially was a convention. Again, we only have newspaper reports to look at for the impact of that. Some newspapers say there were 400. Some say, I think the Davenport paper says there were 700 in attendance. And Clark was elected chairman of the convention to pursue the idea of the right to vote. I think a lot of these soldiers stayed in Iowa or continued their trek north and dispersed through the northern part of the country. Some probably went back to save their families because they had families in the South.
And at the same time as he's mounting this successful campaign to secure the right to vote for African-American men, he also brings suit against the local magistrate's court through the school district. So tell me, Kent, tell me a little bit about this. He was a family man. He had three children.
Yes.
And where did his children go to school?
Well, I think for the most part, their early education, at least Rebecca was the oldest daughter. And I'm fairly certain Rebecca would have been educated at the black school at the AME Church. And Susan probably was educated there as well as youngest child, Alexander G. Clark Jr. I suspect, however, there may also have been a tutor involved in their lives. And I say that in part because there's another one of these curious coincidences that indicates that Alexander Clark paid the salary for the teacher at the AME school. So they may well have, prior to the Supreme Court decision, they may have had their own tutors.
And in 1867, so again, this is right after the Civil War, Susan, his middle child, was 12 years old. And she took an entrance exam to get into...
to apply for high school.
Okay. And this was an all-white school.
This was an all-white school. And the principal issued a letter saying that he could not accept her. The Muscatine Journal wrote a phenomenal editorial about the injustice of that. Later, the suit against the board of directors of the independent school district was filed in district court here in Muscatine. And the district court agreed with Alexander Clark. His daughter needed to be allowed to attend public school because in 1857, the law changed in Iowa that said all children had to be allowed a public education. It's just that nobody paid any attention to it.
Tom, try to help us understand how remarkable this is at this time, that a man would bring suit against the school district to sue to allow his children into this all-white school.
Well, from an African-American perspective, I think it was probably a very scary thing for other African-Americans. It brought pressures and fears, just as the 60s did, 1960s. And I'm thinking that Alexander really felt that the climate was right with the sentiment toward African Americans after the Civil War and this appreciation, and the timing was just tremendously correct. The I think from an African American perspective, he was so well respected and was seen because he was very involved in the church, in the lodge. There were many other facets of his life that we haven't touched on that he affected other African Americans and was well respected because of his organizational skills. He brought a number of skill sets to the table that African Americans just weren't expected to have. So African Americans also had a tremendous respect for him at that time.
So he had a network, he had support in the community, not just from African Americans, but from whites as well.
Absolutely. And the AME Church was the first African American church network in Iowa. And so you found that there were a lot of connections to be made through the church.
We'll talk more in just a moment. We are exploring today the remarkable life of Alexander Clark. And my guests are Tom Moore, Executive Director of the African American Museum of Iowa, Kent Sissel of the Alexander Clark Project in Muscatine, and historian David Broadnax of Trinity Christian College in Illinois. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about the life of Alexander Clark, an African-American man who lived in Muscatine, Iowa, before, during, and after the Civil War. He did some truly remarkable things during his time there and later on in his life as well when he moved on, and we'll find out more about that in just a moment. Right now we're exploring the story that gets told most often about Alexander Clark, although for many years none of these stories were getting told. This history was nearly lost. In 1868, he won a suit, the first successful school desegregation case in the country was in Muscatine, Iowa. The Iowa Supreme Court ruled in his favor, allowing him to enroll his daughter, Susan, in the local school. And the rest is a very long history. I have with me today Kent Sissel of the Alexander Clark Project in Muscatine, David Broadnax, a historian at Trinity Christian College in Illinois, Tom Moore, Executive Director of the African American Museum of Iowa. And David, once Alexander Clark filed suit in the local magistrate's court, what happened next?
Well, he filed his suit in the district court in Muscatine, as you said, and he won at this local level. His legal brief essentially, the interesting thing about it is it doesn't make any sort of glowing statements about civil rights or fair treatment or humanitarianism or anything like that. It doesn't say anything about we've earned the right to go to public school because we fought in the war. It just simply says, I live in Muscatine, I pay taxes, my daughter is entitled to go to the school in her neighborhood, and really says really nothing at all about race. The school board's reply is the one that talks about race and says things like, black children and white children do better when they're kept separate, and this will help maintain the peace, and this isn't about white supremacy or racism, we just want everyone to thrive in their own environment. So they're the ones that bring up the racial issue, but Clark just simply says, I live in Muscatine, I pay taxes, my daughter can go to her local school. And the district court agreed with him and said, there is nothing to, justify keeping her from going to the school in her neighborhood because she lives there and there's no question about that. The school board then immediately appealed to the Iowa Supreme Court, where the case was going to be heard by three members of the Iowa Supreme Court. There was only three on there at that time. And there he makes basically the same argument again, not really a race-based argument at all. But the interesting thing is that I think that that's implied in what he says. By him saying, I live in Muscatine and I pay taxes and my daughter's entitled to go to whatever school she wants to in her neighborhood, he's basically saying, black people are citizens too. Race doesn't matter when it comes to where you go to school. All that matters is, do you abide by the other rules? And the Supreme Court seems to agree with him. And in their decision, they, you know, use the phrase the equality of right, which is, you know, they talk about actually a lot of the things that the Supreme Court of the United States brings up in the Brown decision 80 years later. The chief opinion says that separate schools are inherently unequal schools. If you keep black children and white children separate, then you're going to prevent all American children from becoming good citizens. You're going to actually increase racial tension because one segment of the population is going to feel mistreated and looked down upon. And, you know, even if the facilities are equal, you know, segregation in and of itself is unequal. And so the Iowa Supreme Court says, you know, we're going to force these schools to be desegregated. There's nothing in the state constitution that justifies segregation. So after that, Susan Clark can go to grammar school number 2, and all the other black children in Iowa can go to their local public school as well.
Well, and what happened in Muscatine? I mean, obviously Susan went to school there, and later on her younger brother, Alexander Clark Jr., went to school. Did African-American children from Muscatine, did they actually bring the schools together at that point? Was it total desegregation in Muscatine?
It seems as though there was, and this makes Muscatine a little different from some other cities in Iowa.
Because, of course, the precedent here was set, and other cities in Iowa would have had to follow suit.
Right, they would have had to, but of course, you know, we know that the Supreme Court, you know, whether on the state or the federal level, can say something, but that doesn't mean that people will be happy with it, right?
Well, and Tom, Tom, you look like you want to jump in here. What do we know about other school districts after this case in Iowa as far as segregation went?
Well, I think it just wasn't as enforced as it might seem, even though it's the law of the land. And there were other laws that the other way that weren't really enforced. And so I don't think you saw the thing just go away with that decision. However, it was a giant step forward, and I think it says a lot for Iowa.
Well, and David, the students in Keokuk also, after this decision, they challenged their school district, right?
Right. I guess if you want to keep drawing the parallels with Brown versus Board of Education, Keokuk would be the Mississippi of Iowa because Keokuk actually builds a new segregated school after the Clark decision. So, you know, by this point, it's supposed to be that schools have to be desegregated. Not only does Keokuk refuse to desegregate, but they actually build a new all-black school and are very clear in their school reports, which we have access to, that, you know, this is the colored school. This is the school for the black children. And so it takes two more lawsuits in 1876 by two sets of parents in Keokuk to get those schools desegregated, one with the high school and the other with the elementary school. And those cases go to the Supreme Court, and that was Supreme Court in those two decisions basically just says, we already settled this issue, Reed Clark, you all have to desegregate now. And after that, it seems to have happened to a certain degree. The unfortunate thing is that all the black teachers at the black school in Keokuk immediately lost their jobs once the schools were desegregated. But Keokuk seems to have been the most obstinate in terms of defying segregation. There's other places where it requires a little bit more effort. Dubuque is another one, another place that's kind of known for its racial conservatism at that time. The parents there had to, you know, go the extra mile to get that desegregated. There are other places, on the other hand, where it seems as you have just sort of happened. Mount Pleasant would be one example of that. I think Clarinda is another place where the schools just sort of desegregate, although the students seem to have been resegregated inside the schools in Clarinda.
Hmm.
So the schools are desegregated, but the black kids kind of get relegated to second-class citizenship within the integrated schools. And Muscatine seems to have desegregated, but the black population in Muscatine at this point is so small that we're really not talking about that many children to begin with. Certainly a whole lot fewer than what you'd have seen in Keokuk, for example.
Interesting. Well, let's get back to Alexander Clark. After this decision, a few years later, several years later, his son breaks the color barrier at the University of Iowa, right, Kent?
That is true. That is true. Alexander Jr. graduates from high school in 1873. And is admitted to the law school of the University of Iowa. Coincidentally,
There's so many connections here.
It's absolutely incredible.
And tell me who the second African-American man to graduate from University of Iowa Law School was.
Alexander G. Clark, Sr.
So he followed in his son's footsteps,
he went to law school. Footsteps, yes. Yes.
We're going to run out of time here. There's so much more to talk about. But, Kent, what happened to Alexander Clark? After he graduates from law school, where does he go next?
After he graduates from law school, he's admitted to the Muscatine Bar Association, and then he goes to Chicago, and he purchases part of the conservative newspaper and eventually takes over full ownership of that. We think that Alexander Clark Jr. may have spent time in Chicago as well, so that they have supposedly a law business, but also the newspaper business. There's very little evidence that actually he was a practicing attorney in Chicago, but he did have his law degree. He purchased a share of the Conservator from Ferdinand Burnett, who later married Ida B. Wells. And a few years, I suspect that Burnett was in trouble financially. So I think that Clark took over as publisher, and eventually Burnett bought the paper back from Alexander Clark, and from there he always maintained a residence in Muscatine, but he was also spending time in Washington, D.C.
And he was eventually named ambassador to Liberia.
In 1890, President Benjamin Harrison appointed him as consul general, resident minister to Monrovia, Liberia, yes.
Which, unfortunately, is where he dies not long after that.
Yes, that is where he died.
This story, this remarkable story of Alexander Clark, was not being told for many years. Kent, how did you learn who Alexander Clark was, briefly?
I knew bits and pieces over my lifetime because some people had tried to maintain the legacy. Aldine Davis in 1958 was promoting Alexander Clark in Muscatine. And then in 1968, I was part of a windshield tour of architecture in Muscatine. And, the house was a lovely house, but no one remembered exactly whose house it was. And finally, there was I was with four women at the time. One of the women said, "I think that's the ambassador's house." And that seems to have started more interest in the property and in the history of Alexander Clark. Bertine Motley from Cedar Rapids and Elizabeth Verhuizen, Betty Verhuizen, then in the 70s, took on the project of documenting as much as they could to try and save the property from demolition when there was a 10-story apartment building for the elderly being erected on that site in downtown Muscatine.
And you actually live in this home, in Alexander Clark's home. How did you come to live there?
The house was threatened with demolition so many times that it was incredible. The house was moved. There was an organization that Bertine Motley established, called the Alexander Clark Historical Society. They were promised bicentennial funds from the U.S. Congress to help them move the house. Unfortunately, Congress didn't ever make the appropriation. So the house languished with just volunteer labor, and eventually Bertine was not able to meet the deadlines. There were some lawsuits filed, and I was asked by people in Muscatine, as well as the State Historical Society, to consider, since I'm from Muscatine and my family's here, to consider taking it over. I thought that I could probably take care of that in 2 years, and 35 years later, I'm still here.
Well, and you've discovered, as you were telling us about earlier, you were talking about how your family came to this part of the country.
Yes.
From Washington, Pennsylvania, just as Alexander Clark did. And you have discovered that you through your ancestors, seem to share a lot of historical links with him.
Without a doubt. But, again, they're curious coincidences. And, I can tell you more about that, but it would be it's another lengthy story.
And we are nearly out of time. And Tom,
we suspect that there has to be a connection. We just don't know exactly what that connection is, except for the story that I've already told you.
Right. Well, Tom, this story, Alexander Clark's story, has become an important part of the stories that you tell at the African American Museum in Cedar Rapids. Why is this such an important story for all Iowans to know?
Well, thanks to Kent, we've gotten an awful lot of information to share, far more than we have room to share. As a part of our exhibit, of course, it is a huge part of African-American history in Iowa. And the story can't be told without Alexander Clark as a part of it. African-American involvement in the Civil War, the time period, the early civil rights time period with Frederick Douglass on the national level and whatnot, it all it fits with telling the entire story. And so we invite people to come to the museum to actually visualize the history that we've been talking about today.
Well, and here is this man who, I mean, clearly was a visionary, clearly a brilliant man. He understood the legal system well before he ever went to law school and was able to affect the course of Iowa and really the course of the nation. Kent, why was this story almost lost? Why didn't I learn about this in fifth grade in Iowa history? Why don't we know more?
I think that because of social environment and conditions that this is only one of what I would suspect would be thousands of significant stories dealing with black history that have been lost. People simply stopped paying attention to it, and or because of discrimination, they stopped writing about it. And my best example would be the history of Muscatine County was written in 1911. There is no mention of this whatsoever in the history. I think people simply wanted to ignore what happened with slavery and the discrimination that was taking place. But by doing that, they were being far more discriminatory. That's my opinion.
As we're hearing this story today, Kent, what do you think that we really need to take away from it?
I think we need to pay more attention to our own history because the old saying is, if you don't know where you've been, you don't know where you're going. There are lots of stories in history that if we knew them and if we taught our children these stories, we might not make some of the mistakes we make in our own lives, but also in the life of our country. I think it's important to know that people have made an effort to create a civil society. They get beaten down, but they've made an effort to create a civil society. We're still the great experiment.
Well, Kent, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted.
Kent Sissel with the Alexander Clark Project in Muscatine. You can find out more about the research he's done and Alexander Clark on his website, alexanderclark.org. Tom Moore, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Tom Moore is Executive Director of the African American Museum of Iowa. And David Broadnax, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
David Broadnax is a historian at Trinity Christian College in Illinois. And there is a new documentary, Lost in History, Alexander Clark, that will be airing on Iowa Public Television in the month of February. You can find the times for airings on our Facebook page, Iowa or Public Radio. It will premiere Tuesday, February 7th at 6:30 p.m. on IPTV. This is Talk of Iowa.